We just had the opportunity to explore, see a sort of a conversation around really the question of ethics and looking at the trolley car scenario in particular. What we saw essentially is a couple of things. I think the first thing that's fascinating is that people tend to contradict themselves. We tend to contradict ourselves. We saw in the video that when the students were asked two scenarios that were philosophically almost certainly the same, analytically speaking, if you have the scenario of you're hurtling down at a very high speed in your trolley car and you're going to kill the one or the five, so they're going to kill the one instead of the five, and somehow that seemed different. And this one of the students tried to formulate this distinction. But somehow when I push someone from the top of the bridge, that's different. Even though philosophically he was unable to defend it, and it probably is philosophically indefensible. And probably the same point that the professor was making about the transplant, about the organ donation, that there really probably is no fundamental distinction between taking the organs out of the five in order to, or out of the one in order to save the five, in a scenario where they're ill versus a scenario in which you're just walking into the room next door just to harvest an organ.
I don't think it's the same. I'll let the doctor.
Let me just. You can make the argument. Certainly, the first case though. Leave us on the second.
The doctor is different because there are other obligations involved.
There are triage questions, but it only works from a certain philosophical.
The Hippocratic Oath.
So we're going to come to that. What is the Hippocratic Oath? Also.
Right,
do no harm. We know what it is, but let's say right. So do no harm, but let's. How do you define harm? Right, and what happens if you're limiting someone's lifespan but decreasing their suffering tremendously?
Well, that's where the rubber hits the road.
That's exactly where we're going. I think one of the things that's separate from our discussion is really fascinating is that there's a huge burgeoning literature in psychology that is arguing increasingly that as human beings we are actually wired to make justifications that feel more comfortable rather than purely logical. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive for being logical and rational, but there's also sort of a recognition that maybe even from an evolutionary perspective, the idea of others perceiving us as honest, again, this is not to advocate for that, but just as descriptive, and the idea of even ourselves perceiving our self-reflection, our self-concept of being essentially someone who's basically a good person, basically decent and moral and honest in particular, that's actually something that might well be hardwired within us. So, for example, there are those like Dan Ariely, who's a popular author, and there's a whole genre now, this sort of literature that's arguing that essentially we do this all the time, that the distinction really with which we live is most people lie every day, but the point is, do we see ourselves sort of as liars, as indecent people? We mostly want to see ourselves as honest, good, upstanding people, but you know, no one's perfect. So that sort of thing, there's actually a lot of evidence, again, not to say that this is the right thing, but rather to say this is just something we observe about human nature all around us, and there is a very popular, and I would even say it's hot, this is really in nowadays, intellectually, and popular circles as well, that this sort of notion. I mean, you have others arguing from evolutionary psychology that this sort of the ability to form groups was essential to the survival of the human species, and that ability to be creative, adaptive, and to create teams that are larger than the pack of animals, whatever it might be, that's maybe up to 150 at the very largest, but instead to create a sense of family or shared ideology across countries, across borders, across families and kin, and those within our own immediate geographical context, that has been essential to the survival of the human species from a Darwinian perspective, and you have that whole line of thinking that's become very popular now. If anyone's read *Sapiens*, which is written by an Israeli by the name of Yuval Harari, it kind of traces this argument. It's a history of the human species. It's absolutely fascinating. It's very, very interesting. Highly recommended. Lots to say there, but he makes this point as well. So there's this. I just thought that when you see these students contradicting themselves, and Emily, in the first case, even you would agree, and within the span of moments, it was because one case, and he said it himself. It felt different. When I'm more removed from the situation, then I can kind of say, well, it's just someone falling on someone else down there, and it doesn't involve me. I didn't dirty my hands. But if I'm actually driving the trolley cart, somehow that feels different, not philosophically, but it doesn't force us to confront our actions in the same kind of way.
Uh, after I happen to have seen this tape because he brought it to my attention in some link that you had sent to some, to us. To some.
Because I do this with the TIKVA course, yeah, and we're talking about this.
I don't know how it's relevant to the end of life things, but he talks about moral, that some people base moral decisions in terms of intention, and some people evaluate moral decisions in terms of consequences. Mm-hmm. But in terms of intention, it occurs to me, although I would vote for consequences more than intention, but it occurs to me, and I'm throwing it out because I want to hear what other people think, that maybe the most moral thing to do, if the trolley is not working, is for the guy, the driver, to just let it take its course, and so that he himself is not implicated in the choice of anybody's death. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of consequences, that's the worst case scenario.
That's right.
Because the five people die.
Right.
But on the, I'm just commenting that I could see that reasoning.
Good.
Even if I don't know what I would do. You know, whenever I hear some of these things, I say lo aleinu.
Right. Hopefully not me. And any of us. And we don't have the luxury of time.
I mean, we're discussing this in a medical context, but yeah. I think it's really important to mention that these questions are being argued now in a different context. For example, the context of self-driving cars.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, what happens if, you know, a child walks in the path of such a car and, you know, should the algorithm hit the child or turn into the sidewalk where there could be people going?
I mean, Dr. Renkman was here last year.
Yeah. But, you know, so these are,
and I just want to say
more than medical issues, and they're actually issues that are being grappled with on a lot of levels.
Yeah, 100%. I did this also after Dr. Reichman's talk. I figured it would be a lot of fun to do it with some high school students. I did it actually on Shavuot night. I did this with the high school boys for that slot at
So do that. What? It was not a good slot.
It was not a good slot. I have not. No, that was for students. That was for kids.
Something you did at.
I've discussed it with the girls as well, and it's interesting. They really just very animated by this. The notion that the next wave of technological advancement can be subject to age-old questions that go to the heart of human nature, and that Judaism has so much to offer about these conversations, mm-hmm. is completely eye-opening for them. It's just, they're really receptive to the conversations. I'm glad you mentioned that as well. Absolutely, 100%.
And taking it to the mundane that we've already been doing is people see the sport of football in the same way, that it's okay if one high schooler dies per year for us to have an American pastime that we would enjoy.
Sure.
So industry-wide. That's something that we've accepted. That we know it will.
Right, but somehow, if you're closer to it, then all of a sudden that might sway our opinions.
Completely.
Right. The same thing with frankly aspects of the meat industry. Right. I'm not one way or the other, but there's no question that if you study the, you know, how close I've come to actually seeing what happens, and the incidence of vegetarianism and so on and so forth, I'm confident there'll be a strong correlation. So it's human nature to, when we encounter something, to think about it differently, even though philosophically the problem remains the same.
Just one thing, could Paya explain to us what's the guideline for triage? Do you treat the one most likely to survive, or do you treat the sickest? How does triage work?
So let me kind of take it two pieces. So one, the transplant issue is, you know, just to get it off the table, is really a non-issue. Because, first of all, you know, even, I mean, Kutlum to the premises is just totally, you know, that these people will just live and not have problems. It's, you know, medically not plausible.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
It's just the...
I
used to always tell transplant patients that you're replacing one chronic disease with another chronic disease, but one that gives you a somewhat better life expectancy. But still, you know, you're talking maybe an 80% 5-year survival. You're not talking super. The other, I mean, you know, I'm not an emergency room doc, but the classic triage is really, the classic triage approach is really to mark patients in a mass casualty situation, and this sounds harsh, with people who are not likely to live regardless, people who will survive with medical intervention but need it, and then people with lighter injuries who can wait. I mean, that's the class, and then you just take them in order and you sort of focus on the ones who are most likely to survive, and even though the ones who are sicker could survive with intensive, but that's the classic triage approach that people are trained to do on the battlefield or in mass casualty situations.
Yeah, and we're going to come to, later on, a few weeks out, we'll come to questions of triage as well from a halachic perspective, for sure. And I think that this conversation, actually, going back to the different ethical theories, I think is exactly the foundation for an important piece of this conversation. So just before we get into the halachic sources, so there are a couple of different major philosophical schools of ethics that exist and have existed for quite some time. So I'll just mention a couple, and you'll see immediately how it plays into these questions, but just to give names to some of the different approaches that were taken by students in the video and even around this table. So going back to Aristotle wrote his Nicomachean Ethics, very famous, and he advocates for what has become known as virtue ethics.
Right.
Virtue ethics emphasizes not so much the behaviors of actions at all, but rather the internal characteristics from which those flow. So Aristotle is very interested in what does it take to cultivate a human being with the highest ethical nature that then, when these scenarios arise, will act in a virtuous fashion. And that's gone out of vogue for many, many, many years, but it's actually made a comeback in recent years. Very interesting. In the more recent philosophical literature, the Rambam makes a big deal out of this, the whole idea of the golden mean. When the Rambam says, really drawing Aristotelian ideas, but with some Jewish modifications, the idea that every characteristic, there are two extremes, and we should aim for some sort of midpoint. So, for example, when it comes to my approach to worldly pleasure, let's say eating and drinking and so on and so forth. So one extreme would be starving myself, full-on asceticism, and the other is overindulgence. And the Rambam says a healthy medium is going to be the proper approach. He's not talking about how much I eat per se, he's talking about his language even, is what kind of person am I? Am I the kind of person who has self-control? Am I the kind of person who is inclined toward appreciating what this world has to offer, refusing to do so, and so on and so forth? So there's a whole tradition of virtue ethics, which is relevant generally, but a little bit of an aside, because it doesn't directly answer the question, okay, now I'm in this scenario, what do I do? But it's an important piece of the conversation. And then subsequently, you had, especially in more recent years, you have two major schools of thought, maybe three in terms of intentionality, what Emily mentioned. So the major dichotomy is the question of, do I look at the effect or the outcome? Do I look at the utility of my behaviors, or do I look at the intrinsic valence or character of my actions? In other words, to what extent do I ask the question 5 versus 1, what will be the outcome, what will be the bottom line, versus is there an intrinsic significance to the ethic, to the behavior per se, where it's not just a question of what happens. The question is, as Emily said, what did I do? Did I stand by passively? Did I not actively murder? Or did I take an active step in order to do something? This has been a huge dispute in the philosophical literature for the last few hundred years for sure. The Americans tend to be very practical. We tend to be pragmatic. Americans tend toward utilitarianism. So some of the great utilitarians were first British and then Americans. So you had in Britain, you had people like John Stuart Mill. You had people like
Bentham.
Yeah, Jeremy Bentham. Those were known as the pragmatists, and they were very interested in even economics. There are all sorts of theories of economics today that are an outgrowth of that. Modern economics has largely been about what will create the greatest economic good, i.e. happiness, that emerges from an economic system for the largest number of people. And that's very much utilitarian kinds of thinking, and that will manifest itself in the kind of 5 versus 1. What's the bottom line? The counter to that was Kant. Kant, Immanuel Kant, was adopted what's known as deontological ethics. Deontological ethics is basically the bottom line. The point of deontological ethics is not to look at the outcome. the utility, the consequences of my behavior, but to look at the morality of itself. And it actually goes very far. Kant insists that in order for something to be rational and to be moral or ethical, it needs to apply to all people in all circumstances across the board. He's an extremist in this regard. And so he comes with this notion called the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative means it has to be categorical. You can't. So Kant says either you say that everyone can lie in all circumstances, or you say that no one can lie in any circumstances. As brilliant as Kant was, I still can't understand how he took this seriously as a philosophical position. Because what Kant is saying is that all cases are the same. Either you can always do something, you can never do something. All people in all circumstances.
Or was he saying that it would be wrong if you were to do it? I mean, it's different to say you can't do it than to say
it's unethical.
It is a concession and it is unethical. Even though we know we must live with that as a reality.
That is a fine philosophical position, but I don't think that's what Kant was saying. I would endorse something more along those lines. I'd be comfortable with that. I think you're right. But I don't think that's what Kant says. So anyhow, so that becomes the big divide. And then you have the last piece is, does intention play in? Intentionality. So not what I did, but what I was trying to do. Does that matter? Or no, the only thing that matters is the bottom line. So for example, and we have this in our legal system as well, to manslaughter versus murder in different degrees and so on, if I was negligent by shooting somewhere, and it was an area that wasn't cleared to shoot, and someone ended up dying, God forbid, that might be different than those kinds of scenarios. So those are sort of the... So you have virtue ethics, you have utilitarianism, you have deontological ethics, and you have the question of intentionality, which is part of the conversation as well. And this ends up really, really mattering as well, in addition to triage in general, but in terms of end-of-care life decisions, even for an individual. I'm not pitting one against five. I'm not pitting more needy patients, those who have to come first in the immediate category versus category two and category three. But this is actually one individual. And the question is, does it matter? Is there a distinction between whether I'm actively intervening to end the life versus passively allowing someone to die? Well, if the outcome is going to be the same as that, pulling the plug, and then... If there is such a distinction, well, how do you draw that distinction? Right? If you're pulling the plug, am I causing someone to die? It sure feels like it. It looks like it. But actually what I'm doing is I'm refusing to provide a medical intervention. Is that really different than refusing to give some sophisticated, more advanced treatment at end of life in order to ensure that someone can survive? Or say, no, that I'm being passive. I'm just not providing medication, just like I'm not providing nutrition. And where does an IV fit in? And all these kinds of questions. Is there a distinction between these? Yeah.
If you take another example that I think would be identical, it would seem so obvious, the difference. And the other example is, if there's a traffic accident and you unintentionally hit somebody, God forbid, and they die, you're not going to try that person for murder like you would if you run down a person intentionally.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's, nobody would question that, but mm-hmm. that's...
Absolutely. I think everyone would agree that intentionality has some role in the problem. Whether or not that means it's not defined as murder, whether or not they're sort of two separate philosophical categories is a question of the ethics or morality of the behavior, and then there's a question of a separate question of intentionality, and maybe that needs to be kind of separated out, becomes a different question. But yes, you'd be hard pressed to find anyone who discounts intentionality entirely. I think that's right.
Like there's a whole piece in the middle. For example, if somebody was drunk, even though it was unintentional, that's different than if you're fully awake, alert, and somebody steps in the road right in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And just as in American law and other legal systems, there are these distinctions. You find this in halacha as well. Halacha has onus, where it's essentially the equivalent of being coerced. So you have an actual case of coercion. Someone literally took my hand and made me pull the trigger. You have cases where it's similar to onus. It's reminiscent of that, an unavoidable emergency. No one physically coerced me, but it was certainly beyond my control. And then you have shadings that get sort of accidental. And then you move into area of negligence, which is different than intentionality. And even intentionality can have different gradations in the halachic system. And that's all aside from the question of the directness of my behavior, which is a whole other category. Did I do it? Did I not do it? It was causative, and so on and so forth. I tied someone up before a lion, the Gemara has this case. Tied someone up before a lion. That's actually a case in the Gemara. There's a big discussion about this in front of a desert sun. So it's wrong, it's terrible, the Gemara's not recommending it, but is that the same thing as actually murdering?
This is theoretical, right?
Welcome to the Gemara. The Gemara's got every theoretical scenario. Okay, this is what was happening to the Jews at that time, okay? It wasn't so theoretical. But yes, the Gemara is willing to consider all sorts of different scenarios, and yes, it does not shy away from even difficult scenarios. And this is far from the most colorful instance that we find in the Gemara, but it's to prove the halachic point and to explore and go to the edges. You kind of understand what the underlying principles are. So that's by way of philosophical background, but it actually comes up and becomes highly relevant. You can immediately see that this is a very important frame for so many questions in medical ethics, and Bai is absolutely right. Medical ethics is one important application and instance of a larger philosophical question that has a lot of complexity. Obviously, we could spend weeks and weeks exploring just these different schools and where halacha falls out, but I think as background, it's going to be extremely important and useful in terms of framing our discussion. Now, the other question that's obviously relevant, we started discussing earlier, was the value of life. And this intersects with our question. I want to look at some sources now about that, because the other question becomes, if life is of infinite value in Judaism, or even nearly infinite, or of unimaginable value, inestimable value, then maybe I should argue that I should extend life to the extent possible in all scenarios. And that question of when do I extend life, when do I not extend life, what if by extending life I'm going to cause suffering and pain, and the extension of life is only in artificial means, what if it's not going to lead to quality of life? Is there any role to patient autonomy and to family, the family's role, the doctor's opinion, so on and so forth? How does all of this work together is to some degree going to be contingent not only on the question of active versus passive intervention and this philosophical, ethical context, but also how we view Jewish life. And that, too, is a large philosophical question. And Judaism has much to say about this, and I think there's some tensions or questions about this that are worth kind of putting in the background and are an important backdrop to this conversation. I want to see some sources about that. I'm going to share two. I don't think they're conflicting sources. I don't think they're contradictory, but there's a different texture or feel to them. We already mentioned that it's not a universal in all circumstances. So maybe there are limitations to the value of life, and yet we know Judaism has a very, very high value of life, and more so than other religions and certainly sects of Judaism. In other words, rabbinic Judaism as opposed to other sects of Judaism that were in existence at the end of the Bayashini period, such as the Dead Sea sect and others, for example, there was a major dispute and question, what about Shabbat versus human life? There's a reason to believe that some of the sects that existed during the Second Temple period, late Second Temple period, actually disputed this question with the rabbis. And that when the Gemara says that one is obligated to set aside Shabbat in order to save a life, and when we say that not only that, but someone who is a halachic authority should try to jump in where possible to be the first one to save the life, to make the point, to model for the community, that in part is an outgrowth of this ancient debate that exists kind of behind the scenes with regards to this question. The rabbis were addressing a very live issue. So it's not clear that all groups within Judaism had the same conception, and it also might be tied to their asceticism and a sort of a life-denying kind of philosophy, which you had among many of these groups. It was not uncommon. In the medieval period also, the Karaites. Karaites were highly influential, and they had certainly a more dour approach. They were still mourning the temple very actively. Sometimes you get the sense when you read some of the Karaite literature that it was Tisha B'Av every day of the year, and you wonder why they have not grown in tremendous numbers. That's not necessarily a popular worldview. There is still a Karaite community, though. It should be noted. But what? And it's out. You're a former neck of the woods. That's right. Yes, you had mentioned that there was.
Really?
Wow, really?
Welcome to Northern California. Practice. That's like Lower Merion. There was never color shop when they moved here.
Okay. We're reading the Scarlet Letter and thinking about the Salem witch trials and all those kinds of things. And when I see some of the revival of, well, something along similar lines, it's quite fascinating. Oh. Anyhow, okay. Welcome to California. Okay. Anyhow. Fine. So this question of the inestimable value of life is a live question between what we call traditional rabbinic Judaism and other concurrent approaches, and even within rabbinic Judaism, there's some tensions. So, for example, a recent source of Shlomo Zalman Orbach was one of the great and most humane, outstanding poskim of the 20th century, a very, very important personality. He had a close relationship with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who was one of my teachers. Rav Aaron used to always go on Sukkot. And Rav Shlomo Zalman, although he was a dyed-in-the-wool Haredi, had tremendous respect and appreciation for the value of the Dati Lumi community. He was not one of these rabbis who said, anyone who's a little bit different than me, I'm discounting them from my conception of Judaism. He was the very opposite of that. He was humane, he had his community, and he lived life as a Haredi Jew. There's no question about it, but he appreciated army service, he appreciated the gamut of Israeli society, and had a really compassionate streak to him in general, which is not, I think, unrelated. And he was influential in terms of not, obviously medical ethics was not his primary area, but he had some significant involvement in this area. And he writes as follows in one of his tshuvot, you have it here, Chelek Aleph, Siman Sadi Aleph, his tshuvot are entitled Minchat Shlomo. And he writes that Yan Shel Chayim, the notion of life, he says, Ein Lanu Shum Aknei Mida. This is a modern Hebrew term. There simply is no standard of measurement. He says the preciousness and importance, even outside Torah and commandments, life is of such value that we cannot assign it any sort of measurement. In other words, it's not a utilitarian or pragmatic approach where you say that life itself is subject to utilitarian analysis. You can see how the two philosophical questions that we're talking about overlap and touch on questions of euthanasia and so on and so forth, right? In other words, if we see life itself as merely utilitarian, then maybe if you kill me, but you take my money, right, and you Robin Hood, but on steroids, as it were, right, take me along with it, and you distribute it to all the poor, all my assets, and so on and so forth, or there's some other utility to killing me, so then maybe you can kill me as long as it leads to the greater good. If everything is purely utilitarian, then life itself can be subject to the same sort of analysis. And so you might say, well, the purpose from a traditional standpoint is not maximal happiness in a Bentheim kind of sense, or following Mill, rather it would be about facilitating the observance of mitzvot, facilitating the study of Torah, good deeds, and so on and so forth. So maybe, you know what, you say, life is important to the extent that it facilitates these mitzvot. Well, then Rav Shlomo Zalman says, you're on a very slippery slope, and slippery slope is a very important piece of these conversations in medical ethics. Because then essentially what you're saying is that, well, if I'm incapacitated without any hope of ever being able to study Torah, perform quote-unquote mitzvot, then my life is worthless. And that, he says, is very much antithetical to the Jewish tradition. Lo yitachen. We would never accept such a view. So obviously, life is of much greater value than just the utility that it provides in terms of Torah and mitzvot. He says, I'll prove it to you. He says, let's say you have someone who is gravely ill, but will never be able to fulfill Torah and mitzvot at any point in his or her life. Do we violate Shabbat to save such a life? That's the answer. Absolutely. There's no question. This is not subject to debate. This is not like you find in contemporary ethical circles where there are voices that go so far as to suggest, well, maybe if we really have a utilitarian kind of view, then maybe we should consider it both for the incredibly young and for the old. You have questions about people who are mentally handicapped here, and these are very, very painful, sort of reductio ad absurdum kinds of arguments, slippery slope arguments that are posed against people who say, well, let's allow a person to choose whether or not to give up one's life, because after all, it will lead to greater happiness for this person, for society, and so on and so forth. It's more complicated than making out to be. My point now is only to say that in Judaism, you don't have these conversations in a serious kind of way. It's very clear.
In Katrina, there were all these images of saving, you know, wheelchair-bound elderly people from nursing homes.
Sure.
To great condemnation.
Yeah, so these are live discussions. And Rav Shlomo Zalman says very clear from Judaism's perspective, third line in the Hebrew, Shari Mechalalin et HaShabbat. He says, after all, we violate the Shabbat Gam al zaken chola, even for an elderly person who is ill, mukeshchin, who has right the scabby, right this af apisha who chirish shotev gamor, right? Okay,
we've all been there.
Okay. You can tell he dealt with these issues in a live way. Ve'in yachol asod shum mitzvah v'chayav him rak lema v'chayav him rak lema sav v'sevel gadol mishpachto v'goreim lahem bitul ter mitzvot. Says this person is halachically unintelligent. Is lacking in the halachic status of being right. It's a halachic status of an imbecile. It's unable to learn any mitzvah. Life is a great burden and cause of suffering for the family. And we know that nonetheless, afilu hachi mitzvah b'gdolei Yisrael. Is what I said earlier. It's not just a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah specifically from the greatest of scholars to go ahead and to model this and to be proactive. To go ahead and to try and save him to violate the Shabbat for him. Obviously, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, life is of much greater value than purely functional from a Jewish perspective.
So I'm kind of interested in what he said and what he didn't say, because it's really interesting that he said Lamasa Basevil Gadol Al Mishpachto, as opposed to, you know, Masa Basevil for the person himself.
Exactly.
So that's kind of
well, because
I think that's kind of letting you know, without saying so specifically, because that's not the focus of this tshuva, that there may be situations, not for necessarily Shabbat, where if the person themselves is suffering, where the obligations...
That's an interesting reading. I was reading it differently. I was reading that he's talking about a case where a person might even be in a vegetative state or something like that.
Right.
Oh, yeah. No, that I...
And the doctors may claim, or it may be at least plausible to think, that the individual might not be suffering, so far as we can tell. At least we don't have any measurements or evidence thereof.
Yeah.
And yet,
well, I think
even
very,
in this case...
I think he's very specific that this covers an individual in a vegetative state. But I think
it might also.
But I think the question is what it might not cover is kind of, because he's very careful in his language.
That's right. And when we come to the specifics, I think those are the kinds of questions that we can look at. Exactly.
Yeah.
But in terms of the larger philosophical framing, his point sort of is that larger one. And the truth is, you have other sources that talk about not just the importance of life as of great value, but even my life of having great value, and there being an obligation to advocate for privilege. My own life, where all things are equal, over that of someone else. And here, for instance, two, is Gemara Bava Metzia, which is the classic scenario of two people who are walking in the desert, and you have only one flask of water, and they have to make a decision. This is only enough for one of the two to survive. So what do you say? And the Gemara cites a very interesting debate between two people. And if you look at the end of the fifth Hebrew line, Darash ben Petura, Ben Petura darshins the following. His claim is that mutav shishu shnehem, it's best that the two of them drink via mutu and die, the al yireh echad mihem b'mitato shel chaveron, the other one not sees the death of his friend. So Ben Petura actually goes ahead and says, best for both of them to die. It's like the five dying. Very interesting. Ajabar Rabbi Akiva Velime, that no, that v'chei achicha ima chayecha korbin v'chayei chavercha. He says that no, that actually you have an obligation not just to privilege life, but to privilege your own life. Now, this is so interesting in so many respects. I'll share just two things. Number one, there's some dispute among the commentaries. What's the scenario? Some say this is an any scenario. I'll explain what I mean in a moment, which I think is the face reading. Some others say, though, that no, that we're specifically talking about a case in which I have the flask in my hands. And it's not saying that all things being equal, we privilege one life over the other, but if there's already some default detail in the scenario that makes me the kind of, you know, last man standing, as it were, in this case, or the first one, to have a right to survive, that's the case. There's some interesting thing about that. But I also can't resist but share a brilliant and fascinating suggestion that was offered by Dr. Lamb. Dr. Lamb said, what's this Ben Petura? Because this Ben Petura person, this character, seems at first glance a little bit shady in the sense that we don't really find this Ben Petura elsewhere in the Gemara. It's a little bit of it's an interesting name. What does it represent? So he says, Ben Petura is actually not a real rabbi at all. This is the theory. It's hard to prove. This is the suggestion. And that Ben Petura, there's some scholarship to back this up. He didn't make it up. I heard it from him. Ben Petura is short for Peter. Peter, certainly in the medieval period, but probably earlier as well, is a Hebrew or Aramaic version of the name
Peter.
Right. And that the theory is that Ben Petura is actually representing a Christian view.
Oh, wow.
You should just know, for the sake of...
Not a specific, but a general Christian view.
Wow. That's right. And so this is... What the Gemara means to say is to be polemicizing or to be unpacking what are some of the underlying philosophical differences between Rabbi Akiva, the great champion of the Jewish tradition, versus the Christian view. And the point is, for the Christians, just as we talk about the importance of never hating and always forgiving in all scenarios and never choosing, and this ascetic streak as well, that's not entirely disconnected from that, that it actually plays itself out here as well. And the Jewish value of v'chei achicha, the embrace of life, is of even greater significance in the scheme of things, actually, what the rabbis are trying to accent here as well. And if that reading is correct, it fits in quite nicely with what we saw from Shlomo Zalman. Actually, this Gemara is not only about my life versus someone else's life, but it's just about the value of human life.
At the same time, from a psychological perspective, I could imagine, again, low aleinu, that it would be very difficult to live knowing that you left the person to die, unless the other person agreed, unless you said, I'm going to get help. That's why I'm going to take the water, because I'm going to get help. I mean, what do you do with that?
Right, that's very hard, but again, it kind of goes back to the video, right? In order to avoid the horrors of genocide, he said, you're
going to
kill, right? But you're going to kill, instead of killing the one, you're going to kill the five. So I sort of have the same response here. In other words, no one thinks that it's pleasant or easy or not torturous to live with this sort of trauma.
Yeah.
Holocaust survivors in their own way, survivor's guilt, etc. We're unfortunately all too familiar with that. But if the alternative is both of them dying versus one living with that guilt, presumably from the Jewish perspective, that's what we would choose.
Could you choose to say, I'm going to share my water anyway?
That is an interesting question, not the generally accepted.
But you never know. I mean, you don't know how much you need to survive, and you don't know how little somebody else is going to by with.
It's what Paya was saying earlier, very similar point. I think that that's all right. I think the point of the Gemara is not so much to paskin in the particular scenario, but again, this is to have the rabbis conveyed ethical principles through halachic scenarios. Even philosophy, it's not philosophical work. That's how the Gemara works. The Gemara teaches philosophy. It's perfect for you.
But this is in a way tougher than a triage situation, because, and maybe that's kind of the way out, because in a triage situation, you can see the injury and you know statistically the chances of survival. Mm-hmm. Here, you really don't know if this, flask of water is sufficient for this guy to walk out. You don't know if somebody's walking in and you might be rescued 15 minutes from now. So, I think the Gemara is deliberately presenting a situation that's very stark and black and white. But that doesn't mean that that's the situation that two people lost in the desert, or if you read stories about people who, where one person had a fall, hiking, or they get lost, you usually don't. You don't know what's going to happen,
But the details get us to the principle, though, which is your life takes precedence over the life of the other. So none of that matters. I don't think. I mean, I think it matters. It totally matters. But I think it's trying to get to us to a teachable point, which will then be used as,
right,
the principle by which
that your life takes precedence. But you don't know if this is a situation, if you're lost in the desert or you're lost hiking, that you don't really know that, if you share your food, that this means that you'll live and the other person won't, because you both may not live, or you both might live because you'll be rescued in an hour. You just don't know.
But it is an operable principle in some scenarios. It does give us, it is an important framework. So, for example, when it comes to organ donations, living, right? Okay. Fair enough, right? Childbirth, yeah. if a person has a certain history or is a unique scenario, or in terms of organ donation, as I suggest, right? These, and this becomes the halakhic framework around which these issues are definitely discussed. So I'm going to come back to that. Okay, so today, just to summarize, and then we'll pick it up next time, God willing. Today we started to set our framework. There are different philosophical schools that are very relevant and very live in medical community today that have very deep, not only secular roots, but Jewish roots, and we have then the question of life and how it relates to that. We saw some of the sources that accent the importance or decimal value of life. Now we're going to see some of the other suggestions that would seem to push back against that and say, yes, of course life is incredibly important, but is it really the be-all and end-all value in Judaism? Hmm. And then putting these issues, the question of deontological versus utilitarian ethics and the question of the value of life and how it intersects with the philosophical question, then we're going to come to the question of, okay, is there a difference between, quote-unquote, pulling the plug, or how does that fit in? Is there a difference between passive versus active intervention, withholding, and so on and so forth? What's the framework? We're going to come to a classic position of the Rama, who, based on many of these sources, and I would argue philosophical concepts and background, will give us the beginnings of a real workable framework. We'll see what that framework is, and then we'll try to say, okay, what does that look like for DNRs and for DNIs and for triage and for all these different kinds of scenarios we're going to have to ask, and then how does it play itself out even by living organ donation and brain death and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. how this sort of the superstructure is going to really drive so many of the classical questions that really arise. It's a plan for next week. Very much looking forward.
Is it clear? Thank you, everyone, as always. Is it clear? Are we going to be doing this more than 2 weeks?